last few consoles. There we go. That answers my first part of my question. We are recording it. How do I get the recording? Because I asked for the last consultation recording and I never got it.
Okay.
So who do I make the request
to? Let's do that offline afterwards. We'll figure out how to deliver that to you. Okay.
Okay. Sounds good. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for setting this meeting up for us, Charlie. We appreciate it. So we decided to have a consultation that specifically addresses the issues we've had with OIE. And if you remember last fall, we just did the issues we had with OIE in one part of a multi-part consultation in one session. And this time we decided to have kind of a lengthier conversation because we feel it merits it. And we don't think some of the issues we raised in the fall were addressed, and there's some other issues that have come up since then we kind of want to get at. So I'm sure you shared the agenda on your end, Charlie, so everyone knows that, you know, we have kind of a set of concerns that we've raised, and we'd like to go over each concern and hear responses and hopefully have a productive dialogue from this consultation and leave both parties here satisfied with the results. So the person who's going to start us off here is Terry Fine. So Terry, I will leave it up to you to present your part of the agenda.
Thank you, Robert, and thank you everyone for being here today. As some of you may be aware, we at the union tend to hear a lot of anecdotal reports about how individuals have engaged with OIE, and we're not quite clear on whether or not those reports represent what is sort of the expected protocols for OIE, or whether or not perhaps an individual's experience has been out of those boundaries. And so I've been asked to sort of ask some of these questions as they pertain to what is a reasonable set of expectations about how a person engaging with OIE, what they might reasonably expect. So for example, when we're looking at sort of the concept of success and effectiveness, how does OIE, how is that measured, whether they measure it for themselves or whether a Vice President Bishop, that's something that you measure based on reports from OIE. So what kind of indicators is OIE looking for as measures of success and effectiveness?
Hi, this is Rhonda. So I'm going to let Nancy answer part of this question, and then I can always jump back in. But I think it would be helpful if Nancy kind of talked about all the different things that the Office of Institutional Equity does, because success or effectiveness, and effectiveness is defined for compliance and ethics programs, and OIE is a compliance and ethics program, as whether or not that program has implemented the elements of an effective program as defined by the federal sentencing guidelines and through our Board of Governors regulation that covers compliance and ethics programs. And so I think when she talks about all the different activities that they do, and those elements include things such as appropriate oversight, development of policy and procedures, training, monitoring, investigations do come in there, response to risk and mitigation efforts of risk, and changes to the program as needed to respond to changes in the compliance landscape, right? So those are, that's just a very quick little high level overview of what's required for effective compliance and ethics program. We do a lot of reporting to the Board of Governors every year. We do I report to the Board of Trustees of the university. And so in our meetings, we're providing status updates to them, an annual report that covers the activities of not just OIE, but all of the compliance and ethics offices at the university, as well as we are doing regular reporting to the Board of Governors. I'm going to stop talking and let Nancy kind of talk about her program and kind of the breadth of what they do. And then I think we can address a little bit more specifically about how we look at effectiveness. And you use the terminology success. That's not always a terminology that's used to describe compliance and ethics programs. It's more about the effectiveness of a program.
Thank you, Rhonda. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Nancy Myers. I'm the director here at OIE, and thank you for the opportunity to answer your questions and talk a little bit about the office. So when I talk about our office and the portfolio, I try to start big picture and cover that there's essentially three main areas. The first area is our response to and investigations of concerns of discrimination, discriminatory harassment, and retaliation. And so that can be something as getting a report that doesn't reach the level of that and working with that individual to resource them to the appropriate office or to work with management or to have an informal resolution in terms of training needed for individuals, all the way through full investigations where we are preparing an investigative report and making findings related to whether there's been discrimination, harassment, or retaliation. That response can include a number of things. You know, in addition to the investigative piece, it can be communications with management. It can be communications with threat assessment teams, if there's a threat assessment piece to this. And it can be also connecting individuals to support resources. This second big piece of the portfolio I would describe as our accommodations and remedial measures piece of the portfolio. So our office is responsible for ensuring that there is a process in place for requests for accommodations based on disability, pregnancy, and religion. So we will facilitate all of those requests with the exception of student accommodation requests, which are done with the Student Accessibility Services Office. However, our office has the Section 504 coordinator as part of our responsibilities, and so we are frequently in contact with SAS and providing consultation and support to their work to ensure that their program is also compliant. The remedial measures piece is typically our Title IX cases, and this is where we have an individual who has reported a concern related to someone we don't have jurisdiction over. For example, a student would disclose that they were sexually assaulted in high school. It is triggering for them or it's impacting them in their current educational environment, and we will work with connecting them to resources and options that they have available to them to address what they're experiencing. And we get many of those. We get many remedial measure cases where we are working with individuals where an investigative option isn't available from an UCF perspective, but we can connect them with external resources for investigative options. We can connect them to victim advocates to do safety planning, and again, connecting them to support resources. So that's the second bucket, if you will, in terms of our portfolio. And the third bucket is our search and hiring process. We're responsible for ensuring that the university is compliant with all of our EEO, Equal Employment Opportunity, regulations and laws. And this includes preparation of our affirmative action plan on an annual basis, our preparation of the Florida Equity Report on an annual basis, as well as our oversight in the search and hiring process. In particular, you might all know that we review all the faculty hiring packages that occur in the year. And we also are responsible for answering any questions about process, assessing requests for exemptions from the search process, and what that exactly looks like and how to proceed. Now, with all those three buckets, we also have training responsibilities. So with all three of those areas, we are, need to ensure that the university community understands those obligations and those rights and know what the processes are. So whether it's search and hiring, accommodations, or discrimination, we work across campus to ensure that people know what those requirements are. So an example of that is our Let's Be Clear campaign. It's an awareness campaign that people understand that they have obligations and rights and where to go. We do orientations. We appear at faculty orientations, student orientations. We ensure that there's mandatory training for employees as well as students related to these areas, and obviously our ongoing in-person trainings that we provide to departments and communities across campus. Over the last 4 years, I think we've had about 16,000 attendees of in-person, and that's in addition to our mandatory online trainings that we provide. In addition to that, we also are responsible for ensuring that we provide the information needed for external oversight. As a federally funded university, we have external agencies that can make inquiries. We have litigation, where obviously inquiries can be related to cases that we've handled. And so we provide the support and documentation and resources needed to respond to those things. In addition to all of those things, and again, it fits into these three pieces of the portfolio, is we need to stay abreast of any developments in the legal realm related to civil rights. And if there are changes, we are responsible for updating policies or processes to be compliant with those new laws, as well as educating the community on those changes in processes and policies. So a couple of examples in the last couple of years is the Title IX final rule that came out in May of 2020. That required us to assess all of our policies under Title IX and procedures. It led to the development of an entirely separate policy, the Title IX grievance policy. It required changes to 14 of our UCF regulations, required changes to our investigation process. And so we had to work with campus partners to ensure that we not only identified what needed to be changed, but we did make those changes and then implement and educate the community about those changes. We have the Florida Influence Statute, which is a recent Florida statute that is impacting a number of areas, including the search process area. We had a Fairness in Women's Sports Act, also recently from the Florida legislature, relating to some of our athletic programs on campus. We had the critical race theory executive order by former President Trump that also impacted our assessment of trainings on campus. So those are the types of things that can develop in the legal realm that we need to be aware of and then assess our policies and procedures related to that. So I think that gives you the kind of big scope picture of the day-to-day work and responsibilities of the office. And I'm certainly happy to answer any questions about that, or Rhonda, certainly let me know if I missed something.
So is there an evaluation tool, like for people who've engaged with the office, is there an evaluation tool for you to see how the individuals with whom you have worked have responded or have perceived whether or not you have fulfilled the responsibilities that you've just outlined?
So in terms of, we don't have a survey. We do have a survey related to some of our trainings to get feedback on those so we can continue to improve in those areas. In terms of our investigation process, under our investigation procedures, there is a provision that sets forth that all individuals have the option, if they would like to submit a written response to our investigative report or their interaction with our office. And so parties sometimes take us up on that, sometimes they do not, but they have the option to submit in writing whether they agree, disagree, think that we got it right, got it wrong, what their experience has been.
But is that for investigations only, or for assessments of merits or dismissal before an assessment of merit? Is it only for the investigation that a person could submit a response?
No, it's not limited to that. I think the procedural rules are set under the investigation section, but my office, Matt and Ricky is our assistant director, and myself are always open to feedback. So they can certainly submit their feedback via email if they're more comfortable with that, or reach out and set up an appointment with one of us. But that's where the procedures capture, I think, is in the investigation section itself.
And I think also, just at any point in any of our processes, just like any university function, if anyone has a question or if they have concerns, you know, they can always interact directly with that office. You know, for the offices that report to me, someone can always, you know, share their concerns with me for us to have a discussion or address, and or oftentimes people just have questions about the process, and we do receive those, whether they come to us in email or people call us, or we may even have people submit that through the integrity line.
And how would a person, just as a quick follow-up, if a person doesn't get a response to expressing a concern, what would be their most appropriate next step? if an email isn't answered, for example.
And has that come to me, or are you saying if it comes?
I'm just saying, just generally speaking, if you're saying, you know, I'm hearing that there's no survey, so that there's no way for a person to sort of how was your experience type situation, but we're welcome, that any person is welcome, we generally, to send in a concern. How are those concerns responded to, and is there a commitment to respond to every concern, or is a non-response considered a response as well? I mean, what would be a reasonable expectation for someone who did respond to either their own experience or someone else's experience that they might be concerned about?
So our goal is to always respond to everyone, and not just the OIE team, but all of the compliance offices do a lot of work to respond to the university community timely. They're like everyone else at the university. Oftentimes, workloads are fairly heavy, so it may not happen immediately. But the goal is to always respond very timely and address those concerns. I'm not aware of cases where people are not receiving concerns, not receiving responses, rather. But our goal is to always respond, and to whether you're submitting a concern, whether you have questions. I ask that of all of my teams, to try to respond as promptly as possible.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Robert, those are all my questions.
Okay, so I'm sorry, Rhonda, do you mind if I have a follow-up here?
Absolutely, go ahead.
So I might have missed this, maybe I wasn't paying careful attention, but what are the tools or the metrics that you use to evaluate the effectiveness of OIE? Because as I understand, you're ultimately the person in charge, right?
So I'm looking, as I kind of described in the beginning, I'm looking to make sure that the program has implemented the elements of an effective program, right? And that they are performing that work, that things are being conducted in a reasonable amount of time. And I use reasonable because it depends on what is the nature of the work that they're doing, right? Some things take longer than others, but that, and that we're, for the most part, meeting the needs, the compliance needs of the university, whether it's being developing a policy timely to meet a new federal requirement or a new state requirement. Nancy talked a lot about in the past year, it's been a lot of new statutes. And so my teams have been involved in implementing new procedures, implementing new policy. And that can often be quite timely, right? Because it goes through a feedback period and we have to make changes and working with the appropriate stakeholders. So now from an overarching compliance and ethics program perspective, annually, all compliance offices are surveyed for their activities underneath effective elements. And so we're assessing the programs. This is a report that goes both to the board, and then it goes to the Board of Governors that outlines all of the work and activities of the compliance and ethics programs. When it comes to, for example, like the integrity line, which reports that get handled by the Office of Institutional Equity, they kind of come in, they get triaged, and they may be sent over to them, or it may be a joint investigation with that office and the compliance and ethics office or university audit. Through those reports, we're tracking the concerns that come in, how those are handled, whether they're substantiated or not, and we do a whole trend analysis every year looking at that data. Also, Nancy can speak to, but you know, her team is also working monthly with the compliance and ethics team. They meet on a regular basis to assess projects that they're working on, whether it is investigations or the development of policies and procedures or training. And the team is tracking those activities within their databases and making sure that the university is moving in the right direction and that we're in compliance with the requirements that we have, but also that we're being very responsive. So it happens in across a couple of different places. There's a lot of meetings that go on. All of my direct reports meet with me every other week, where we look at what they're working on at that time, and I set expectations for what we should be accomplishing in our offices.
So what I heard in your answer, Rhonda, and I think at least three different times, was either a description or even the employ of the word data. So can you talk us through what exactly this data is, how it gets to you, and what form it comes in?
Well, what data are we talking about specifically?
I don't know. You said you use data, right?
Yes, yes.
So tell us the data. What is the data you use? How does it come to you? In what form? Is it quantitative? Is it qualitative? You said a survey. What is the nature of the survey? How does the data from the survey come to you? What form is it? That's the kind of thing I'm after.
So the survey that we use, and this goes out to all compliance offices and compliance partners, we survey them every year for their activities underneath the elements of an effective program, right? So policy development, what trainings have you done and how many people have you trained? What monitoring activities are you doing, right? And how often are you doing that and how many have you done? So those are just kind of some examples. You know, are there things that they accomplished? For example, what new regulations came that you had to respond to during the year and how did you do that, right? So that's the type of survey that goes out to all of them, that underneath the elements, they're responding on their activities, and that rolls up into the annual report for the university of all the compliance and ethics activities across the university. So that's the survey tool that I'm talking about.
Okay, so is there any data collected to measure the effectiveness of claims and complaints that come to IE to determine whether people who register a complaint and it is investigated, reported, so on and so forth? Is there any cumulative data or aggregated data that's collected that is used in your judgment of how effective OIE is?
So I'm looking for a few things, and you're asking me, what am I looking for to see if they're being effective, right? Mm-hmm. I'm looking to see if, and this is part of that ongoing meeting of, you know, how are we handling the work that's in front of us? So are you referring to particularly investigations? I think in your question, it sounded like that's what you're talking about.
Yes, so not necessarily individual, but more quantitative. So is there, like, you know, there were X number of complaints and those complaints were adjudicated by these reports, which I'm just making all this up, obviously, but, you know, 85% were, you know, addressed in some way, shape, or form. I mean, is that the kind of data that comes to you that you use to measure the effectiveness of OIE?
So what we're really looking at, because I think it's really important to understand that in the investigation of any matter, you know, no two matters are completely the same, right? Some can be resolved very quickly. Some can be resolved within a few days, right? Some, it may take 3 months. Some, it may take 6 months. Some cases may take a year or more, right? Depending on the complexity and what's involved in those particular cases. So what we're looking at on a regular basis is, you know, what cases do we have open, right? What progress is, I want to see regular progress on those cases and how are those cases progressing? Do we have any challenges in those cases that we need to address, right? And then how are those cases finalized? And then for OIE, because they have particular procedures, I'm watching to make sure that they're following their procedures, right? And so in my discussions with Nancy, either I'm receiving the final report, which when there is some type of disciplinary action, those reports come through me first. If there is not, then they do their normal closeout memo, right? So when I'm meeting and talking with Nancy and we're going through open cases, these are the things that we're talking about. And that's part of my supervision of this area.
Sure. So what you're describing to me is more a qualitative evaluation based on stuff you're seeing and the way things are flowing through the office. Now, in what way, shape, or form does that end up in a report to the Board of Trustees or, you know, some other governing agency that you report to?
So when we're talking about what goes to the Board of Trustees, that's through the Integrity Line report that tracks the complaints that have come through and how they were handled and whether they were substantiated or not substantiated. Because also we're looking for trends in data, and right, we're looking for trends. If we continue to see very similar concerns, whether it's in one area or multiple areas on campus, that may mean that we need to respond differently, right? Provide additional training in that area, or we may have some growing issues in an area. Nancy and her team are looking at particular individuals, right? If we've gotten more than one complaint about an individual, right, there may be a problem that needs to be addressed in a deeper manner. So the reports that get provided to the Board of Governors and the Board of Trustees are the annual report that I talked to you about that all compliance offices and compliance officers complete that survey, our Integrity Line report that goes annually to the Board of Trustees, and then I am just giving the board regular updates, right? And the Audit and Compliance Committee, regular updates on the work that we're doing and what activities we're doing and how that's progressing.
Okay, I want to move us along. So I think you got it, all of my questions in some way, shape, or form. And I want to transition us to another issue, which Rhonda, you actually brought up in your comment previous to your last comment. And this is the amount of time something gets adjudicated and or reported, I should say, I'm sorry. I shared an article in the chat, and I'm being serious and genuine in sharing this article. I'm not being glib or anything, but it just, a friend of mine sent it to me a couple weeks ago, and was based on her graduate school experiences at Michigan State University with a specific history professor who was a known predator, known sexual predator of students and colleagues. And this is the OIE office at Michigan State University who finally came to some resolution in addressing these two students who were married, graduate students in history who were married in the late 1970s, early 1980s, who had a problem with this specific professor that I mentioned, and they ended up leaving the program, not finishing their PhDs. And just recently, I think a few months ago, the OIE office at Michigan State University decided to kind of rectify what had happened. And unfortunately, it happened, you know, almost a decade after this specific professor under focus had passed away, right? And so the reason I'm sharing this is because this is, you know, I'm sure on some level an extreme case, but it documents the problems that come with cases being dragged out too long. And so we kind of want to get at what point does the office, what point, Rhonda Bishop, do you see has these cases kind of being dragged out too long? What's the measure you use, or what is the expectation that you all have that these cases can be can be wrapped up in some way, shape, or form?
So it's a good question. B, it's not always easy to answer, but I'm going to point to OIE's procedures. The team has a goal on average, and please understand there is no law anywhere that requires that investigations are done within a certain time period. Really what the emphasis is on is that they are sufficiently investigated. If we look at the federal government itself, whether you're talking about the EEOC, which I believe they have a timeline of a minimum of a year. Is that correct, Nancy? I think it's a year. Other federal agencies that we work with have taken anywhere from 2 to 5 years to complete their investigations. And this has been my experience at not just UCF, but other universities where I've worked, that the federal government takes a long time, and hence why I think we don't see a legal requirement to complete investigations within a certain time period. Now, our goal is to always complete our investigations as timely as possible, but we also don't want to move so quickly that we're not being fair and balanced to everyone who's involved in a concern, right? Whether it is what we call the complainant or the person who is the respondent. And so where we try to aim for an average amount of time, and right now in OIE's procedures, they have allotted 90 days as an average, and that means you're going to have things below and above and beyond. And the team is meeting that goal with the understanding that occasionally there may be some outlier cases, and we've seen those cases. And these are typically cases that are very complex, or sometimes when a complainant comes in, they may not want to move forward with their case right away, right? They come in and talk about it, but they don't necessarily provide permission to move forward with a case. And I'm talking specifically about Title IX cases when I'm referring to that. So on average, I think the most recent review of timelines, I think, showed you coming in at, on average, 89 days, Nancy? Am I correct on that?
Right, 89 to 90, yeah.
And I think it's also important to remember the university has dedicated more resources. You know, when I first got to UCF in 2011, there was one person in this office. So over time, the university has appropriately put more resources into OIE. We're a very large university. There have been a lot of changes in law under Title IX and also to equal employment obligations of the university. And so there is much now a much larger team over there. And so over time, gradually, and this is at the same time where I think the office and I think the compliance program as a whole has done a good job in communicating the resources available and that we want people to report their concerns. So the number of concerns have increased drastically. The university has also increased the resources over there. And at the same time, we have been able to see that over the last several years, that the time to complete an investigation, that average time has fallen to a much lower number. But I just want to add the caveat, that doesn't mean that every single case will be done by 90 days, right? There will be some outliers that take longer because of the complexity of that case. And, and we had that case last year when it took every single team member, not only within OIE, but also within the compliance and ethics office, to respond to the thousands of concerns that we received about one individual.
Okay. I'm going to hand the rest of this query over to Shelley, if you don't mind picking things up.
Okay. I was going to ask questions about timeliness. It seems like we're already well into that. So you say, an average 90 days, which of course means sometimes less and sometimes more. Can you walk us in a little more detail through the process? What is the average time it takes to process a complaint? What is the average time it takes to determine if the complaint has merit? What is the average time it takes to investigate it and then to resolve it? And then I'm also interested in how and if the complainant is kept apprised at each step of the way, in terms of what's happening and why.
So I'm going to let Nancy, because you're kind of moving, and it depends on what type of case that we're talking about.
Let's just say it's a case of a faculty member who is experiencing sexual or racial harassment by a colleague or a supervisor.
Okay. Nancy, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. So I think I'm going to step back a little bit just in terms of, because you asked about different procedural points, and I don't have the average numbers for each procedural point. The 90 days that Rhonda was talking about is our investigation timeframe. So as she mentioned, that front end of a case can look very different depending on the circumstances. Some individuals will come in and say, you know, here's a concern I'm having, but I want to know more about the process. I don't want to share a lot of details. I don't want to tell you who the respondent is. I want to just learn a little bit more about the process, right? And so we will certainly provide that information. We will do follow-up. You know, sometimes they re-engage with us, sometimes they do not. And so we will make that effort. We generally try at least 2 outreaches, sometimes 3, you know, via email, via phone call, you know, when individuals have reported some concern. Sometimes individuals will come in and say, these are all the things that have happened. This is a person of concern. Still not sure I want to move forward. I'm concerned about retaliation. For instance, a student sometimes is in a class, has concerns about faculty members, says, I want to wait until my class is done, and then I'm going to come back and talk to you about the process more. Right? So that front end can look very different depending on people's circumstances. And then others will come in and say, this has happened. I want to move forward with the complaint and investigation, and we can proceed forward. The assessment of merits process, I think you mentioned jurisdictional, or maybe Terry, you did, you know, the jurisdictional assessment and the assessment of merits. We endeavor to do that as soon as possible. Now, I won't say that happens in 5 days because I don't think that would be an accurate reflection. It depends on a number of things, the complexity of the case, the workload, whether we have a case like Rhonda just referred to where everybody has been pulled off of their duties to work on one particular matter. But we try to do that as soon as possible in the case and get that individual to another resource to assist with the concerns that they have. Once we've moved into the investigation realm, we let the complainant know that. So if we do an assessment of merits or jurisdictional dismissal,
I just want to stop at the merit decisions just for a moment, so I'm sure I understand it. So who's deciding whether or not the complaint has merit and on what basis?
So I think it's important to understand it's not a merit assessment in terms of is there a violation or not. What we do at the assessment of merits process is we credit all of the allegations. So the complainant comes in, says all of this happened. We credit those as being true. We're not assessing whether it's true, untrue. We're crediting, saying, yep, let's assume everything happened exactly as the person described. They can give us videos. They can give us emails, any supporting documentation. Once we have that, then we assess if this was all true, would this violate the non-discrimination policy? If the answer is no, that's when we issue the assessment of merits decision. And that will go directly to the complainant.
And by non-discrimination policy, you mean the legal policy, not UCF's policy of being a welcoming place to everybody.
It's the prohibition of discrimination, harassment, and related to personal violence policy.
We're talking about law, okay.
The policy goes beyond the law. So okay. the policy captures
the
more than law.
UCF policy. She's talking about the UCF policy.
Okay.
And we're not assessing under Title VII, Title IX. We use federal and state law as guidelines in terms of our assessment, but we are not making a determination this statute was violated. We are making a determination that this policy was violated.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So once the process gets beyond the assessment of merits stage, we are issuing a notice of investigation to the respondent. The complainant is alerted that that is happening, that the notice is going out to the respondent. And then at the conclusion of the investigation, the complainant and the respondent both receive a copy of the investigative report.
So while the investigation is ongoing and taking an average of 90 days, but perhaps if complex, much longer, Is there ongoing communication with the complainant to let them know where things are at, or are they just sort of left hanging? Because part of what we keep hearing is that it seems like there's foot dragging and the people and unresponsiveness or greatly delayed responsiveness to things. So I'm wondering what kind of communication happens as this is going on.
Sure. So the expectations with the investigators is to alert the parties when it is going beyond the expected time frame. We also tell all the parties to check in with us if they want to know the status. We have some individuals who check in frequently and we'll provide them with a status. Sometimes that status is it's still under investigation. We can't provide further details because we're in the midst of the investigation. Sometimes individuals, you know, will reach out at around the 90-day time frame. And check in because they have it marked on their calendar that was the approximate time frame we had given them. Sometimes I will, even in our cases, I will say I estimate that the report will be ready on X date, and I know that it's not going to be when that date comes around. I will send a follow-up email alerting the individuals, and our investigators also try to do that with the parties involved. But we always encourage the parties to circle back to us so they don't feel like they're left hanging.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people are felt like they're left hanging. It might help if the circling back went the other direction and didn't just rely on the complainant to try and follow up. But how I do understand that some things are more complex than others. Part of the difficulty is if somebody's experiencing discrimination or harassment, is that they're having to continue to deal with this. While the investigation is going on, is there anything put in place to try and protect the complainant from the situation that has been alleged and or from retaliation in that situation because they've made a complaint while this process is dragging out?
So anytime a case comes in, we are assessing the circumstances, and every case can look different, as Rhonda had mentioned. There are sometimes circumstances, depending if we're dealing with students or employees, you know, so in the student context, we are sometimes moving students into different living locations. We are at times looking to move people into different classes if that's possible. In the employment context, you know, it also depends on who the parties are, where they're located, what is the department like, who, you know, is this a supervisor relationship, is it not? And there are some cases, though they are the not the bulk of our cases, but there are cases where depending on the nature of the allegations, someone is placed on leave. And so those are assessed in every case that comes into our office as to what measures can and cannot be implemented.
Is there anything that would help hasten the process? For instance, is it your sense that you could do this work more quickly and thus more satisfactorily from the point of view of those who are suffering harassment or discrimination if you had better staffing or if you had various, what kinds of institutional things might help you do this in a more timely fashion?
I think as Rhonda mentioned, the administration has been receptive to the request for support. So she mentioned when I got here in 2017, I had one Title IX coordinator and I had one assistant director. I had no other investigative staff. They transitioned the student responded Title IX investigations to my office with my first 6 months here, and they provided three new staff members to support that work. Within the first year, I went back to administration and said, based on the volume we're getting because of the Let's Be Clear campaign and based on our volume I'm seeing, because we had implemented a database so I could see the numbers, I said, I need another staff member to respond to these in a timely way. I was given a third Title IX investigator for that. With the assistant director position, the individual resigned and I went to administration and said, I'm again looking at the volume and the timelines, I need additional support, so I would like to essentially waive my assistant director position, use that money, and create two EEO investigator positions. But obviously, I would need more funding to create that second position. And again, administration supported that. So it's a constant discussion, and Rhonda and have it on a frequent basis. What is the staffing looking like? What are our resources? And that additional staffing has resulted in the timelines coming down. When I look at the timelines back in 2017, 2018, the average was about a year in terms of our cases. So in that time frame to, you know, our recent numbers of being down to 9 days has shown the improvement that's come with that additional staffing.
Do you feel that your staffing is currently adequate to resolve things in a manner that is actually timely?
I think on the Title IX side, definitely. I think our staffing has shown that when we've had all the positions fill. I am still assessing on the EEO investigator side. I have 2 full-time investigators for that work, and I have a deputy ADA coordinator who is also supporting the accommodation work. That position was brought on last year, and so we are assessing whether an additional EEO investigator is needed to support the work.
And I think we can also look at this from a different direction, and this is why training and education and what type of culture we expect here at UCF becomes so important. You know, everything shouldn't lead to an investigation, right? If there are behaviors that are happening in an office or a college, you know, they can be handled there initially, right? Like we don't, to be really honest, we don't want things to end up in a position where it needs to be investigated. And so I think that rolls into, you know, the other piece that Nancy talked about where the team does training and provides resources. There's lots of resources on their website. But also I think, you know, the ongoing culture that we have here at UCF and what we hold ourselves to and what type of behaviors we hold ourselves to in our units across campus, I think also becomes really important because I think all of you know the university needs resources across the campus. And so whereas the university has responded to providing more resources to OIE, there's lots of resources need, even if we talk about our faculty to student ratios, right? So I think we also have to be balanced and how we think about staffing areas. And whereas, you know, a lot of people go through the OIE process and are extremely satisfied, you know, there is always a chance that someone may not like the outcome that happened, or they may feel that the process took too long. But our goal is to always move as quickly as we can with the resources that we have and based on any complexities or challenges of a situation.
Okay, let me turn it over to Dr. Sandoval. I may have other questions later.
Okay, thanks, Shelley. Hi, everyone. Good to see so many of you, even though it's not everyone's favorite topic, I'm sure. We wanted to spend some time also clarifying a couple of other pieces of the process that some of us are probably more familiar with than others, and certainly across faculty, there's a really differential understanding, and specifically about looking at what does this look like when we have differences across complainant and respondent, and also what this looks like for discipline. So I'll start with discipline. I know that you all are not the disciplining agency, right? Of course we know that. But what is the process when a violation has been found to have occurred? What is then your relationship, your office's specific relationship to the disciplining folks? Do you provide recommendations? Is there a list of possibilities? Do you leave it completely up to the official who might be in the position to discipline somebody who's been found to violate that policy or right?
So this is going to come back to those elements of an effective program. And part of one of those elements is effective and consistent discipline, both reward and discipline. And so when we make our recommendations, and they are just that, they're recommendations back to leadership, management, you know, what we're looking for is that we're being consistent in the approach to discipline with like matters. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So in other words, you wouldn't have someone that was very strictly disciplined and in the same situation, someone else got a slap on the wrist, right? We always provide a recommendation where we're trying to achieve a consistent approach. But beyond that, then it moves over to the appropriate, if you're talking about faculty, for example, right? It moves over to the appropriate policies and procedures and what's in the collective bargaining as far as how faculty are disciplined, right? We're not involved in that process where we give our recommendation. That then kicks over to the team that handles that piece to work with management. We are always here as a resource to answer any questions that either management or that office has about our investigations and the findings or details in that investigation.
So just to clarify, you do still provide recommendations even when it is a faculty matter?
Yes, based on our investigation, we provide recommendations, but it is up to management to make that decision. And then how that is executed follows the appropriate policy for the employee type.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we would very much like to see folks have a consistent response across like matters. And we know that that's not what happens. And not, certainly your recommendations may look that way. But I think what we hear from a number of people or the outcomes that we see is that because there is so much room for different kinds of discipline, which may or may not be, you know, the right approach to this, we don't necessarily actually see it executed in consistent manners across like matters from college to college, from department to department. And so explaining some of the limitations of this process to folks who are then harmed by that inconsistency can be challenging for us, as I'm sure also for you. The other piece that we get a lot of inquiry about or that we've run into some challenges with in the last few years is what an investigatory process looks like and what the application of some policies look like when it's applied across employment statuses. So for example, somebody could have a complainant could claim harassment by any other category of person. And this is, there's always a power differential. We know that. And there are some additional complexities. So if it is a faculty member who says they are being harassed by a student, or a staff member that says they're being harassed by a student versus a student being harassed by a faculty member or a staff member, there seems to be perhaps some inconsistencies in the ways that we're able to respond to protect a faculty member in a situation where they are experiencing harmful behavior and activity from somebody who is deemed to be in a lower power position. And so we've seen that come up a few times. And we're wondering if there are different approaches, if it's just fundamentally different, whether a student files a complaint or a faculty, or if you have measures in place for there to actually be equity in that experience.
So I think it's helpful. It's a great question. So I think it's helpful to understand our process is sometimes driven by who is the respondent. So your initial kind of, you know, a complaint can file against any individual in the classifications. If it's an employee and it is any type of discrimination, that's the OIE process. When it comes to students, if it's a Title IX, so a sex-based related allegation, that too will be OIE. So a faculty member believes a student is subjecting them to sexual harassment, that's going to stay with OIE and follow our process. The difference, though, in that case is we have, instead of at the end it being management that would respond with discipline, in those cases with student respondents, it would be the Office of Student Conduct process. So instead of following the faculty grievance process, it's going to follow the student conduct process. Now, if it's a complaint against a student respondent that is not Title IX, that does not come through the OIE process, that goes through the Office of Student Conduct process, the Office of Student Rights and Responsibilities process. And that is a result of when the transition of cases occurred in 2017, it was to bring Title IX investigations into OIE. It was not across the board harassment allegations. I think another important distinction is when you say the word harassment, is there's a difference between discriminatory harassment and generalized bullying, right? So if it is generalized bullying, it's not protected class-based, that is not coming through OIE. But that could go through the student conduct process depending on the nature of the conduct. It could be disruptive conduct, and I forget all the different elements that they have, but they have different ways to address that behavior. Generalized bullying is, my understanding, Ron, to certainly jump in here, is management is responsible for addressing that type of conduct, and they can utilize the code of conduct to do that. And certainly Rhonda's team is available if it's some elevated type of case that they need the additional support.
And just to clarify there, in those cases, and she was referring to bullying, so OIE will refer those cases over to the Compliance and Ethics Office for review, right? And they may investigate working with the department, if that's reviewed and in discussions with the department, it's a better fit to be reviewed there. And it, once again, it depends on what the details are, right? It may be something that can be easily addressed with the department, and we always maintain oversight to make sure there's some type of response to the concern. If it doesn't look like it fits there, then it gets investigated by the compliance and ethics team. But regardless, the issue gets responded to. The concern that's been raised gets responded to.
In these situations, is it the same process then for protecting the complainant during the investigatory process? So I've certainly, represented a lot of faculty who receive a notice. Make sure you don't retaliate. This is happening. Here are all the things that can be considered that. It's trickier when a faculty member says, a student is sexually harassing me, or they are disrupting the class. I am fearful. These are very real things, not at this institution, but I had a colleague who was stabbed in her class at my last institution. These are very real concerns. But it seems like there's not the same kind of process to tell a student, don't retaliate because there's no power against your faculty member while this investigation is happening. But there is a lot of anxiety and precarity around possible harm that then not only impacts that faculty member, but now probably the entire class. And there just hasn't seemed to be things that we can mitigate that with. So does that look different in your process, or is there just nothing to do because of the power dynamic?
I personally don't see a difference in the process. Retaliation is retaliation. And the university's been very clear, we're just not going to tolerate that, right? Now, sometimes it's very difficult to prove retaliation, right? Especially when you've got two individuals involved and no one else is around, right? There aren't other witnesses. It can be very challenging to prove those cases. And I think we have to remember that what can often be challenging is, we have to respect the rights of both the complainant and the respondent, right? But the university will and has taken action, whether it is removing people. So let's take an example of a student, right? A student could be removed from a class. Absolutely. We do have a crisis assessment team. You talked about the example of at another university, a faculty member being stabbed. There is a crisis team that evaluates students who may be considered to be in that zone where they may hurt someone else or themselves, right? We do have that team here that can look at that. But definitely when it comes to retaliation, and we say very clearly in our policy, whether in our reporting concerns and protection from retaliation policy, it applies to everyone equally. It applies to the entire university community. It is not just a faculty member or a staff member. It applies to students too. Now, of course, we're going to work with student affairs when addressing those concerns, right? Because through the rules that cover our students, they have the ability to take student conduct action to remove them from a classroom, for example, right? But we would work with them through that process.
Okay, I'd love to maybe unpack that a little bit more, because in my experience working on both sides of it, I've had faculty members say, this student absolutely needs to be removed from my classroom. I'm not safe. Other students are not safe. And I've had students say, I absolutely need to be removed from this faculty member's classroom. I feel fundamentally humiliated because of a comment they made about my identity or something like that. So I get it from all these different sides. I absolutely direct people to the office of OIE and give them all of their options. But my experience is that it is tremendously difficult to move a student out of a class for either side of that argument. And I'm not saying that it should be easy with just the press of a button that we can just move students around. That sounds like chaos, but it does seem that there is something else in the middle where it doesn't, because if it takes you an entire semester to move a student who should be moved from one class to another for whatever reason, that class is over. That student has likely not done very well in it. The entire environment, you know, the timeline of these things, all these different response teams, it doesn't seem like it's a very coordinated effort sometimes. And the time it takes, and then the increase in stress and anxiety and lack of wellness now for students and faculty in that process become huge concerns for me in some of my positions and certainly my colleagues here. And I don't know if there's a standard for, like, a person has to be deemed by this team a threat to themselves or others in order to be removed, or if we can document certain behaviors, if that can happen more readily. It just hasn't been my experience that we're able to do that. And I have seen folks go a little bit around that system to try to make things work, move a student into an independent study with another faculty member, like whatever we can do to get people through and out. And that just shouldn't, it shouldn't create more labor for other faculty or affect other students' experience, because there is harm happening to one or more parties.
Well, I just want to first thank you for sharing those concerns, because obviously I think we all want to feel good in our workspace, right? Whether we're in a classroom or our office. So thank you for sharing that. But I think those situations are challenging, right? Because what's the tipping point? And so I think some of this that we kind of moved into probably goes beyond us and maybe more into the student affairs realm, right? And how student rights and responsibilities are maybe responding to concerns about students. And I don't think we're the right office to speak for them, but I think overall what I'm hearing is we may have a gap. I do know in the cases that we are involved in and that we handle, the challenge is, like I said before, everyone involved has rights, right? So, and so what I mean is, just like we wouldn't just automatically remove a faculty because a student alleged a complaint, we wouldn't automatically move a student without some level of due diligence. And that's just that due process that we have built into all of our processes, with the exception of if there seems to be some type of risk of harm, right? That's different. And I think that's when that crisis team does their assessment. But I think what I'm hearing is from the perspective of the faculty, there needs to be a mechanism to address that sooner. Did I understand that correctly, that we might have a gap there on how maybe some concerns with student behavior and the classroom is being addressed? Capture that?
Absolutely. And I think also there is a gap in understanding who to work with. I think that in some situations where we've had faculty bring things to individuals who are on this call or to our teams of representatives, we say, well, that seems like it should be out of this office. And then we spend 3 or 4 weeks trying to figure out who can even address it, what the threshold for harm is, how to document it. And again, this is just extending this experience and escalating it into a different space. And many faculty, and I'm sure that students also feel this way on their side, and I recognize that these are complicated to look at, but many faculty express that it seems students have more rights than faculty in some of those situations, right? That they are still expected to show up in unsafe conditions of all kinds all the time, and that students are promised a particular kind of experience. It's not necessarily true. I also can't just move a student who's decided that a teacher is homophobic, right? And sometimes that would be the better situation, but it's difficult. But if a faculty member doesn't know where to go, students seem to figure out pretty quickly how to get to a program coordinator, a director, a chair, and a dean. And then a faculty member goes to their chair and they say, I don't know, right? Like, we can't move students. It's the middle of the semester. There's nothing I can do. Then they come to us and we say, well, this might be an issue of harassment. And so, yeah, there's a massive gap, right? And I fundamentally think y'all still are understaffed, Nancy, right? Based on the size of our institution, because we have to have folks who can respond to faculty rights. And that's hard to do when we have 70,000 students that also have rights that tend to get centered in some of these situations.
I appreciate that feedback. I think that's really helpful. So thank you for that. And I'm going to share just your thoughts around this with my colleague, Adrian Frame, who's over student affairs, because, you know, some cases maybe don't even need to go through us. Maybe they just need to go straight to student rights and responsibilities. I don't know. I don't have an answer. And of course, I think we'd have to get into some details around examples to really understand what type of situations are maybe occurring that the faculty are having to deal with. I appreciate that feedback and thank you for the vote of support on resources. You know, it's a tough question for us to answer because of course we always need more resources, right? So that we can respond faster and do more. I think the challenge is always, how do you balance that against the needs across the rest of the university, right? Mm-hmm. But I appreciate your support for us having more resources. So thank you.
Yeah, I think equity is a foundation. I don't know how we can do anything else if folks don't have humane and equitable working and learning environments. And I think it's good to have historical memory. Things, of course, used to be worse. And we still have a long way to go, right? It's a both and. And I think many of us are pushing for that. But Robert, I don't know if you had any follow-up on this particular set of questions, but I think you're next anyway.
Well, I was going to ask that we be kept apprised of further developments in these issues that Jen raised that seem to have no immediate answer. Rhonda, you said you were going to talk to folks on your end.
Well, I was just going to share that with Adrian Frame, just because I don't really think I'm completely qualified to speak on everything that that her areas do to respond to concerns related to student behavior, right? I'll share that with her, and
if any policies or changes come about, that kind of stuff is what I'm talking about. Like, you'll give us feedback based on our conversation. We've realized this, so this is the result. Like, that's the feedback we're expecting after this.
And I think we'd be, correct me if I'm wrong, Robert, but we'd of course be willing to meet with Adrian as well if there's something we can do to understand the gap and where is the process that we can recommend for faculty so that we can do our part in our role of creating those environments for faculty too.
Absolutely. Let me just say this, has the, I believe I'm the resident historian here. No one else is a historian, but the labor union is a resource since the early 19th century. And I see no reason why we're not a resource for UCF as well. That's professionally speaking, All right. Let me just say that before I kind of wrap things up, because I have one last thing I want to point out. Are there any other questions before Shelley?
I'm just also wondering, because it's as I've heard people speak to various issues, it seems to me that circling back to where we started, right, that you are responding up the totem pole, right? So so you're judged as doing a good job if your supervisors, the board of trustees or people, right, think that you're doing a good job. That would be very odd for us as classroom teachers if our students had nothing to say about our teaching and it was just decided by those above us. So I'm wondering if you would be open to formalizing what seems to be a pretty loose and informal system right now for feedback from complainants and people who have cases that they're bringing to the office.
So Shelley, let me talk a little bit. You know, my role as vice president, I'm part of the president's leadership team, right? And so anytime I receive concerns, I have a responsibility to respond to those. Anytime the president may receive concerns about any of my functions underneath me, I have an obligation to respond back to him. So I think, you know, there seems to be this assumption that there's no response or feedback cycle. You know, if people have questions or concerns, we most certainly do respond to that and address those when they come up. And the truth is, you know, I think, you know, that's part of my obligation and my job as overseeing these areas, right? And to communicate to both the president and to the board how the teams are doing, but they have an expectation that we're providing programs that, to the extent possible, are meeting the needs of the university. Does that mean it's 100% perfect? I think we all know none of our areas across campus are 100% perfect. We're not always, just like our faculty don't make every single student 100% happy, but we, right, because everyone has differing perceptions of what that means. But overall, we're achieving what the goals and objectives of our functions are, right? And overall, we're meeting the needs of the university. And so I'm assessing that across all of my teams. And then the president assesses me, right? The president and the board assess me that I'm meeting that part of my role at the university.
I understood. I think my question was, would you be open to part of the feedback loop, right? This is obviously not the entire feedback loop involved. Would you be open to formalizing a process whereby there is a feedback, an automatic feedback form for anybody that has been involved with your office in terms of investigations, filing complaints, and so forth, so that there would be systematic data collected the same way we have student perceptions of instruction? And that doesn't mean that we expect every student to love us, but it does give us patterns over time. I say this as a former chair as well. You can tell when there are patterns over time, right, for an instructor. I'm just wondering if you would be open to more systematically gathering that information.
Yes, thank you for that. So let's talk about the nature of investigations. And I will tell you that is not a best practice in any industry that does investigations. And the reason being is that the nature of an investigation doesn't make people happy. It just does not, right? So let's take a case where a complainant makes raises a concern, and there's an investigation. There's a respondent involved that's obviously not very happy that they're even have concerns alleged against them and they're part of a process. And then the outcome is that the respondent is, you know, we don't have a preponderance of the evidence that the respondent did something wrong, right? Well, of course the complainant's going to be upset, right? Because that investigation did not have the outcome that I think they would have wanted, right, or expected when they went into it. The respondent may be happy, but still probably not happy that they had to engage and go through the process to start off with. So whereas I'm open to having that discussion with my teams, I will tell you It is not an acceptable practice, an accepted practice in investigations, because investigations themselves are very challenging, and oftentimes no one's happy through the process, right? I have to be really honest. I wish we didn't even have to do investigations. I would rather be focused on a lot of the proactive work we do. So whereas I can discuss that with my teams and think about what that may or may not look like. I have concerns of one, what the responses to those would particularly look like. Two, whether or not we would always get balanced responses from people or constructive responses. And then I think sometimes, you know, individuals that have already been involved in the process, some of them just may not wish to participate at all. So, you know, I think it's a little bit different than an assessment that happens in a classroom, as compared to individuals who have had to go through an investigation process.
I just one last follow-up. I agree that it's different, although there are parallels. I mean, we have students we've given a failing grade to evaluating us, and they're not happy, right? So what becomes important is creating an instrument that will, in fact, be useful to you, right? So it's not just were you happy or weren't you happy, but creating an instrument that asks more specific questions that are not about happiness per se, but about various elements of the process, and, you know, for feedback. And you would probably have to tweak that instrument as you went along, because you would find certain versions of it didn't work, just like we're constantly tweaking the SPOI instrument.
Thank you. I appreciate that feedback and recommendation. So thank you.
So Shelley got us to where I wanted to end on, but I want to follow up with Shelley's point in this. One thing we haven't talked about, as far as these possible evaluations of people who've had experiences with OIE, is the need for their own closure, right? I mean, because you're saying yourself, like, their experiences with this office could be, you know, in some way, shape, or form, anywhere from difficult to traumatic. And so that would, in some way, shape, or form, color their feedback. But I think giving them the opportunity to make the feedback, you know, is really important for these people going through this process. And I think, you know, speaking as a faculty member, and I hear this all the time, and I'm sure those of us who are also faculty here can attest to this, but, you know, there's a feeling on this campus and a feeling, especially now in the era of COVID, that we as employees, as people of the UCF community, are not being heard. And it's impacting morale. And I think, you know, something as simple as saying, you know, we'd like to hear your feedback about the process. What are your thoughts? Please share them with us, because someone will read this and, you know, take interest in it, would go a long way in communicating to the faculty community that this office is a resource for them. Because, you know, what I've heard throughout this entire consultation was that all of the metrics of effectiveness, all the things that people, you know, determine are important, are communicated up the chain to the Board of Trustees, have nothing to do with the faculty or whether the faculty are happy or the faculty feel that, you know, the process has helped them. That never is part of any evaluated measure. At least that's what I've heard in this consultation today. And I think by doing what Shelley is suggesting here would go a long way to say, you know, we hear you, we want to hear you, and we want to understand. And I think that in it of itself is going to be beneficial for OIE and the compliance office.
So I would like to say we do get feedback from people. I feel like we're talking about this a little bit as that people are not providing an avenue to give feedback, and through the communications, whether it be in Nancy's office or other offices, when we're working with individuals, they're always told that they can reach out to us. And so over the years, I've received lots of emails back from people thanking us for our work. thanking us for working with them. We get those notes that come back to us through the entirety line as well. We also, you know, if we've had people that have concerns, we try to engage with them to help to resolve those concerns. Sometimes we're able to do that. Sometimes it is just a difference of opinion, or there may not actually be anything for us to do, but it's just that perhaps, for example, a respondent that's maybe charged at the end of an investigation, they may just not be happy with the facts of the case and how the case turned out. We accept those, whether they go directly to Nancy's office or come to my office, or, you know, sometimes they go to the president and they get sent over to me. We do actually receive a lot of very positive feedback from people.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You're talking about unsolicited feedback, right? Not solicited feedback.
Well, when we're
that's the difference in what we're talking about here.
When we're working with groups, we tell them if you have any questions or any concerns or anything to share, you can reach out to us. And that is a routine communication that we're giving to everyone. Is there something that gets mailed out to people? No, but that is a consistent communication that we have with individuals that we're working with.
I don't think we misunderstand that you do that. It's just, the question was about systematizing it, soliciting it, doing it in a more formal way that allowed you to detect patterns and not just random people who happened to reach out.
Okay. Before we leave here, I guess I'll have to get with Charlie on this, but Rhonda, I assume we could request the report you give to the BOT on the effectiveness of the various offices. I'm assuming that's all probably in the BOT agenda whenever you do that, right?
Are we talking about the annual report that we do? Because
ones you mentioned earlier when you said,
yes,
I do this report, I do that report. All those reports, I'm assuming, are public record, right?
They are public, yes.
Okay.
And they also get posted to the Compliance and Ethics website, so you can go out and look at them.
All right, fantastic. Well, I want to thank everyone for showing up. We're close to the end here, and I think we've exhausted all of our questions in the agenda, thank you for showing up to speak to us, and everyone on my team, thank you for showing up and supporting consultation here.
I would just like to say thank you for inviting us to come and have this discussion with you. I'm happy to hear that there's so much passion around this topic. And so thank you for your questions and your feedback today. We greatly appreciate that. So thank you for your willingness to engage with us.
And I want to thank you as well. And thanks for, Jen, your support on the resources. You have been a constant in that. And so I have appreciated since my time joining UCF. But thank you all for sharing the feedback. It's always helpful for me to hear what, you know, the conversations are that are happening outside the office, because we are always looking to grow and improve and be the resource that we want to be. So thank you for that feedback.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
So bring it up.